Good morning and welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and with me for the rest of the hour is Leonard Krystalka, better known as Chris. He's the director of KU's Natural History Museum and Biodiversity Institute, and he's joining us from the studios of Kansas Public Radio in Lawrence. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you?
Pretty good. How about you?
I'm terrific. Thank you for having me on the show. It's a pleasure to be on Central Standard.
Well, so right now, the Natural History Museum is working on raising funds to restore the panorama, which is one of its signature displays, if not the signature display. Describe for our listeners what the panorama is and why it needs to be restored.
The panorama is one of America's cultural treasures. In 1893, part of the panorama traveled from Lawrence, Kansas to Chicago to represent Kansas and the Kansas Pavilion at the Columbian World's Exposition in Chicago. And it attracted as many as 20,000 visitors a day. What the visitors saw was astonishing to them. For the first time for all of them, they saw a recreation of the Rocky Mountains and the Great Plains, the environment, the animals, and the plants. There was a walkway through the panorama that they could stroll and get very up close and personal to the bison, the elk, the caribou, the coyotes. It was the first time that nature had been captured and in a taxidermied fashion, and presented to the public on such a magnificent scale. At the end of the World's Fair, the panorama came back to Lawrence. It brought the world back to Lawrence and back to Kansas, and it was expanded and installed in a museum that was specifically built to house the panorama, now the Natural History Museum and its larger biodiversity institute. It is the signature exhibit of the Natural History Museum. It is the largest uninterrupted panorama in the world. There's one that is of the same age from 1893 in Norway, but is not as large. And there's one at the University of Iowa, but that is more recent and also and not as large. And neither of those have the kind of history that the panorama at the Natural History Museum has.
Well, this panorama, like you said, it was cutting edge when it was created and unveiled, and now it seems in some ways like a relic taking you back to some other time period, another way of looking at the natural world. And I think that that can be a good thing, but what has changed in this time since it was created? Because it's not clear, it's clearly not the history of the natural world itself that has changed.
Correct. Rather than a relic, I think we should think about the panorama and many of the other dioramas in natural history museums around the world as works of art. These are incredible works of art involving incredible artistry and an incredible science that went into the formulation of these dioramas and especially the panorama. So visitors to the Natural History Museum now see in real life, they see the real material, the real plants, the real animals, the life of North America stretching from the equator, from the tropics, all the way to the Arctic zone. So they'll see tropical trees and polar bears and walruses. It is one of a kind. And if it's thought of as a work of art, it needs to be conserved as a work of art. Through the years, since its installation in 1903, it has suffered terrific degradation from fluctuating levels of heat and light and temperature and humidity. It's some of the mounds have been attacked by pests. So we have embarked on a long-term project to preserve this American cultural treasure for current and future generations, both Kansans and visitors from the region, from the nation, and from around the world. The first step was a very detailed conservation assessment by a professional firm called Tucker Brook and Associates. And we are awaiting their report on the actual state of the panorama each of the animals, each of the plants, the soil, the background paintings, to see what kinds of measures are best taken to preserve this work of art and this American culture treasure for the future. Well, Chris, and that's when we plan to start involving the community in a discussion on how best to exhibit the panorama, maintaining its tradition, but updating its educational and entertainment message.
I'd like to jump in and ask you about this idea of it being a work of art, which is an idea that I love. I think there might be a lot of people who would hear references to art as being a reference to something very subjective and human, whereas people like to think of science as being the realm of objectivity. And so how do you reconcile that, or how do you recommend that your visitors reconcile it?
Science indeed strives for objectivity, but every scientist will tell you that science is also extremely subjective in in the choice that scientists make in what to study, in the choice of methodologies, in peer reviewing research and published papers and grant proposals and so forth. You can't completely eliminate the subjective from science, nor would you want to. But that's why the power of science is that it's continually checking itself, and whether through observation and continued experiment, the results of science are always being checked again and tested again and again and again. And if it appears that subjectivity has caused incorrect conclusions, they are corrected, and we go on. This is how science, and indeed the entire body of scientific knowledge, has grown throughout the ages. Art is also extremely subjective, but there's also an objective. I think a lot of art critics would say that there are some objective criteria in judging art and in evaluating art and in making decisions about preserving art.
Interesting. Well, one of the other things this kind of brings up is that you mentioned that people are coming and they get to see real animals and plants. The world has changed. You know, we have the ability to travel with greater ease. Photography brings so much of the world to us. And now, you know, you look on YouTube and if you feel like seeing a panda today, you can. How has the evolving technology of the world and the sort of shrinking of the world changed what people are expecting and what is unique about the experience of going to a natural history museum?
That's a very good question. What remains unique at natural history museums is exactly what the panorama and many of the other dioramas exemplify, and that is we have the real thing. Yes, you can watch YouTube. Yes, you can go see films. Yes, you can watch Nova and Discovery Channel, all of which are wonderful. But they are in a visual sense and in a digital sense, they're fake. It's all fake. It's not real. You can't reach out and get close to the animal or plant. You can't see the actual animal or plant. Whereas, or the dinosaur skeleton, or the skeleton of the saber-toothed cat, natural history museums present the real thing. And it's now, increasingly, one of the few institutions where you get the real thing. You don't get avatars. You don't get digital recreations. You don't get Photoshopped images.
Why
you
is that important?
You get the real thing. It's important to... I think it's viscerally important. I think it's cognitively important. I think it's emotionally important that the visitor make a connection with the real object. And in so doing, natural history museums are better prepared to carry out their mission. The reason natural history museums are here and will continue, certainly the one at the University of Kansas, is very basic. Our job is to census the life of the planet, and we haven't gotten very far. We've only censed this 5 or 10% of the planet, some of which we present in our exhibit, and many more of which we present in our scientific studies. if we only know about 2 million species on Earth of plants and animals, and yet every estimate says there's at least 15 million species, we're only dealing with 5 or 10% of the evidence. How far would chemistry have gone if we were only working with 5 or 10% of the periodic table of elements, for example? Not very far. So biology and all of its downstream products, pharmaceuticals, agriculture, human health, has a long way to go. We need to census the life of the planet. The other reason for having the real thing is to educate the next generation of biodiversity scientists, all the students at the university who are studying biology and other related subjects, and ones who are studying in the humanities. We have art students that come into the museum and lie on the floor and draw the animals and plants and the skeletons of the dinosaurs and other fossil organisms. It's our job also to use the real specimens to educate the public, to increase science literacy. I just wrote an op-ed column a week ago for the Lawrence Journal World on the sad situation when an Associated Press poll found that the majority of Americans don't believe that climate change is occurring. They don't think the Earth and the universe are older than 5 or 6 thousand years, when in fact they are billions of years old. They deny evolution. Perhaps by having the real specimens rather than the digital stuff, we can have a much greater impact on increasing science literacy.
Chris, have you ever had anyone come to the Natural History Museum and object to the scientific truth as you display it?
Yes. We have tours. Groups that do not agree and do not think evolution ever occurred, or do not think that the Earth is and the universe are as old as science says it is, regularly come to the university and to the museum and give their own tours, and we welcome them. We hope that their exposure to the exhibits will make them think about what they are saying and perhaps give them a different appreciation of the awesomeness of the science that they are seeing.
We were just talking about some of the subjectivity of science, and how do we go about this project of distinguishing subjectivity from sort of total open-endedness? How do we parse good science from bad and truth with a capital T from gray area?
Science itself, it's one of its major tasks, is to separate good science from bad science. There's many, many examples of science making mistakes, publishing the wrong conclusions, which are eventually found out, corrected, and we go on. Science is perhaps one of the best enterprises at self-correction and at growth through self-correction. This is why science is always testing its observations and its experiments.
Go ahead. Please continue.
Okay, I'm trying to remember what your original question was.
Oh, well, that's okay. I guess.
Let me try and add something on that scale. I think the public trusts science. The public wants to trust science because they see that science self-corrects, science produces what eventually becomes fact, laws, and true theories, theories like the speed of light and gravity and evolution and so forth, for which there are mountains of evidence that cannot be denied. It's also interesting that museums have a unique role to play in public education and public literacy of science, in that a number of studies have established that of all the institutions that disseminate information in the United States, it is museums that are the most trusted by the public. They trust the information they see in museums more than they trust the national news, more than they trust any of the television channels, more than they trust any other institution that disseminates information. This means that museums have an enormous responsibility in honoring that trust and in presenting the best and most accurate information that we can. And not to be ashamed to be advocates for that accurate information. Because, for example, when it comes to the environment or the or planetary stewardship of the life of the planet, who else should do that but museums? Because we have the information. We have the potency of doing the scientific studies on forecasting what happens to biodiversity with, for example, with climate change. And we have the trust of the public to believe what they see in the museum. So we have an enormous responsibility to present the correct information and not shy away from being advocates of how that information should guide planetary stewardship and environmental policy.
Well, I'm going to get back to some of that in just a second, but if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM, streaming live at kcur.org. I'm Gina Kaufman, and with me right now is Leonard Krzysztolka, better known as Chris, the director of KU's Natural History Museum and Biodiversity Institute. He's with us from the studios of Kansas Public Radio in Lawrence, Kansas, and we certainly appreciate their help. Chris, I want to talk about how you get all of that information you were just referring to. According to your website, there are 120 scientists at the Biodiversity Institute whose research contributes to the collections of the Natural History Museum. I don't know if everybody understands what a collection at a natural history museum is and how it evolves. Can you explain that?
Yes, terrific question. If you add up the collections at all of the natural history museums and herbaria around the world, that would equal about 3 billion individual plants and animals that have been collected worldwide through scientific expeditions, brought back to their respective museums or herbaria. They've been prepared and then stored and archived for study around the world, and they've been preserved for this kind of study to last for generations. In, say, in the last 20, 25 years, in addition to actually preserving the actual plant specimen and the animal specimen, we've also taken and preserved tissues from these specimens and stored them in ultra-cold freezers or in cryogenic facilities so that we can study the DNA and the genetic codes and the genetic evolution and genetic characteristics of these organisms. In totality, these collections can be studied again and again and again, and they document in the best way we know how. They document the biodiversity of the planet. They document the 2 million species we know, and among those 3 billion specimens are probably many hundreds of thousands of species that are yet to be studied and described as new.
If you see the specimens in storage, I happen to have had the privilege of walking through the ornithology collection with a scientist, and living might not be the first word that would jump to mind when you walk through that area, but in a sense, you're describing a living collection. Can you explain some of that?
Right. So if you walk through the ornithology collection with the collection manager or one of our scientists or faculty curators, they'll open the drawer of this big white case and they'll pull out a very long white drawer, and you will see specimens, birds, arranged in neat little rows with tags on them. The specimens have been prepared to last for many hundreds of years. The cases are airtight. not to allow in pests and great excursions of temperature and humidity. On the tags are written the basic information of what the species is, where it was collected, when it was collected, who collected it, and some other environmental characteristics. That information is now in modern databases, and that information is combined with advanced computational technology with temperature and landforms and ecological information to do what-if forecasting of what can happen to this particular species of plant or animal with climate change or with other kinds of environmental changes. This is now a very powerful tool. We can use both the physical specimens as well as the data associated with the specimens to predict how will, say, climate change cause the spread of disease vectors from southern areas into the United States, or the potential spread of agricultural pests into the United States and start harming agricultural industries, or the spread of invasive species that threaten to disrupt our ecosystems, which are the support systems of the planet. Other scientists will study the actual anatomy of and morphology of the physical specimens to see how they are related to each other. What are their evolutionary kinships based on their physical characteristics? They'll then test these conclusions using the same kind of analysis of their DNA. What are their DNA codes show about their relationship to other similar birds or more distantly related birds? Finally, we'll try and reconstruct, using all of this information, how did these birds get to that particular spot where they were collected? Where did they migrate from? In a field called historical biogeography, how did the animals and plants of the world come to be distributed in the places they are now? Why do some areas have certain species and not others? What are the barriers to the species spreading from one area of a continent to another continent, or from one continent to an island? We have, for example, a huge study going on in the Philippines right now, dealing with the amphibians and reptiles, and trying to explain how did all the species get to all the different islands of the Philippines, much like Darwin did in studying Darwin's finches in the Galapagos. And, of course, the same kind of studies go on with, if you go to our entomology department and you pull out a drawer and you see those hundreds of thousands of pinned beetles and butterflies and moths. The same studies are occurring with them. The same studies are occurring with all of the our 500 or 600,000 fossil vertebrates, the fossil fishes, amphibians, reptiles, mammals, and birds. How did they evolve, and why do they look the way they do, and why did some of them become extinct and others did not?
There's something I'd like to ask you, which is just observationally, it seems like the aesthetic of natural history and the aesthetic of taxidermy are kind of popular right now, and I wonder how that affects, does that affect people's reception of your natural history museum or how you do what you do?
I think it does. I think the taxidermy is again related to the fact that visitors never want to lose touch with the real object. All the other media are wonderfully entertaining and wonderfully educational, but it is exposure to the real specimen, the real work of art, and every taxidermied and animal and plant and preserved plant is in many ways a work of art. And when they can stay in touch with the real thing, with the real work of art, That's when the connection, that's when the bond is made.
Okay, well, I'm sorry, but that's all the time we have for this morning's conversation with Dr. Leonard Krystalka. Thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Dr. Krystalka is the director of KU's Natural History Museum and a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at KU. Tune in tomorrow as we look at how talking to strangers can be a source of happiness. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's it for today's show. Stay tuned for Up to Date and the Political Pundits next.